Have you wondered what classical Lutheran education is all about? Are you a Lutheran homeschooler, pastor, or teacher? Would you like to be equipped to teach more effectively? Join the Consortium for Classical and Lutheran Education July 15th through the 17th at Concordia Seminary in St. Louis. Find the conference schedule recently posted at ccle.org. Discover the education that is our Lutheran heritage, ccle.org.
When it comes to the resurrection, that's a tricky subject for the historian. I write in my book that by definition, the resurrection is an ahistorical event, and so therefore historians have no business commenting upon it. But what is a historical fact is the claim to the resurrection. So let me just be clear one more time. The historian cannot talk about whether the resurrection, quote-unquote, happened or not, because that's a matter of faith. It's outside the bounds of history. What we can talk about is the undeniable fact that very soon after Jesus' death, within 2 or 3 or 4 years, the belief in his resurrection had already become firmly embedded in the doctrine of this movement.
That's an audio cut from our recent interview with Reza Aslan, author of that best-selling book, Zealot, The Life and Times of Jesus of Nazareth. He, along with, recently it was Bart Ehrman as well, and I think John Shelby Spong. We talked to those two individuals recently here on the program, all three of them making the same claim. The resurrection is inaccessible as a fact to us. It simply cannot be verified. You can believe in it if you want to, but that's belief. That's not fact. It cannot be examined. It's not only too distant from us in time, but it's also a miracle, and miracles, by their nature, they claim, are inaccessible to examination. They can't be put in the category of facts. Is that true? Joining us to talk about the evidence for the resurrection of Jesus Christ, Craig Parton. He's an attorney in Santa Barbara, California. He's United States Director for the International Academy of Apologetics, Evangelism, and Human Rights, and he's author of a chapter in the Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for April, Making the Case for Christianity. Craig's chapter is titled, The Resurrection of Jesus Christ on Trial. Craig, welcome back.
Thank you, Todd. My pleasure.
You actually spend time in the courtroom.
I do.
As part of your vocation. The courtroom is a place of facts, where only facts, not feelings, not beliefs, not notions, matter, and it's about establishing facts, I assume. And someone's going to say, and how would you respond? Look, the resurrection is in the realm of belief, not of fact, and so the resurrection does not belong on trial in any kind of courtroom.
Well, I'll tell you, no lawyer worth his salt in the courtroom would hold to that kind of position. The fact of the matter is, courts of law look at the evidence for whether an event took place or not. And the guest that you had on, Aslan, talking about the fact that it's a known fact that the claim was made, but it's a matter of belief whether the resurrection occurred or not. Where do you get that distinction? How does he know the claim is even factual? Because all of this comes from the exact same material. The material of the New Testament documents doesn't make any distinction between the claims about the resurrection and the data concerning the actual fact of the resurrection itself. That is an imposition being done by the interpreter, and it's illegitimate. Courts of law look at what the evidence is. They don't look at whether you really want it to be true, or whether it violates a, quote, known law of science or of nature. It looks at what the facts actually say. And in the reality of it is, every trial that is done in a court of law is a recreation of history. It is recreating what may have occurred in the past. And lawyers do this all the time. Trials do this all the time. And when lawyers weigh the evidence, and historically as lawyers have looked at the case for the resurrection itself, they've found out that that evidence comes in the same first primary source documents that give us the information about the claims of themselves of the apostles concerning Jesus and his ministry. So a court of law wouldn't have any problem with this. In fact, trial lawyers have tried to discredit the resurrection by applying laws of legal evidence and a number of them have become Christians themselves, and probably no other secular profession other than the law has more people writing on the defense of the faith than lawyers do.
Now, before we go on to talk about and lay out the evidence, such as it is, we do need to say something about the nature of proof in any court case, but especially in the case of the resurrection of Jesus Christ. What is the scope of that word proof? What do we actually hope to see at the end, either when we say either proven or disproven?
Well, the law doesn't require absolute certainty in issues of fact. The reality of the matter is that no question of fact ever can rise to 100% certainty. It's always a matter of probability. And in the court of law, in fact, you can convict someone and send them to the gas chamber on a standard that isn't absolute certainty. It's moral certainty beyond a reasonable doubt. That's the criminal standard. It's not complete certainty. It's not absolute certainty. So the law says the burden of proof is on the person asserting the claim, and here it would be on the person asserting the resurrection of Jesus Christ. And he would have to establish that in a civil standard is to a reasonable degree, a reasonable probability, in a criminal standard beyond a reasonable doubt. And in both cases, the law would look at what the evidence actually establishes on that basis and not look to trying to ignore the evidence based on presuppositions about what can or cannot happen. The law is very, very clear on this. And in fact, you know, most trials are unique events are being recreated. They've never happened since then, and they never happened after that. They're a unique recreation of an event, and many of them go back hundreds of years. I recently tried a case where the documents involved were over 100 years old, and everybody had died who knew anything about the subject. And the court had no problem taking evidence about what had happened 115 years ago in a dispute between the entity I was representing and the plaintiff. So, you know, theologians, those in religious studies, etc., come up with these divisions between facts and belief. The New Testament knows nothing of it. It grounds that belief. It calls for belief in the resurrection, but it's based on a fact occurring. And in fact, in 1 Corinthians 15, Paul says, if the resurrection hasn't occurred, become a hedonist. Don't become a moralist or an ethicist. Become a hedonist, because tomorrow we die and there's no purpose to living.
So this isn't, when it comes to the resurrection on trial, this isn't about eliminating all other possible explanations at all. It's about which is the most probable explanation of the probable explanation.
Right. What is the most probable explanation? And you don't also come in with the presupposition of asking what's the most probable natural explanation, because that leads a lot of thinkers to say any explanation but that God raised him from the dead and that he's God in the flesh has got to be more acceptable than what the evidence shows. No, you go with the most probable explanation based on the actual evidence that you have. So is it a probable explanation that Jesus was a Martian, like von Däniken's theory? Is that possible? It's possible, but is it probable? There is absolutely no evidence to support it. Is it possible that Jesus just spiritually resurrected and showed himself spiritually to the apostles and they convinced themselves that he was raised again from the dead in the flesh? It's possible. That's a possible explanation. But is it probable based on the evidence? That's the standard that should be applied to questions of fact. And the law has no problem that the evidence is never to 100% certainty. And it'll still find a verdict, and a life or death verdict in the court of law based on less than 100% evidence of certainty.
So in principle, we are not going to dismiss something because it is a miraculous event. We're going to look at the evidence and the testimony and the eyewitness and things, right?
Yeah, you wouldn't believe all the weird things that happen at trials, Todd. I mean, it's possible. I do defense of people in other professions, and the medical profession, for example. You're not allowed to present the defense it's bizarre that my client would leave his cross pen in the appendix of the plaintiff. Well, it may be bizarre, it may be weird, it may never have happened before, but what's the evidence that the doctor's cross pen fell out of his pocket during surgery and ended up in the appendix? I don't know what the odds are, but the question is whether that in fact occurred or not. And the law is very careful on that. It doesn't dismiss something out of hand just because it's got a very slim chance of occurring. It looks at what the evidence is. And the other question that was you were talking about is the importance of this. You shouldn't conflate the fact of the resurrection with the level of evidence that you require to prove it, because if you do that, then you're going to require all kinds of higher evidence for events that you think are unlikely or important to you. For example, how much evidence would you need to convince you that Napoleon lost at Waterloo if you're a Frenchman? You might require a huge amount of evidence, whereas a Chinese person may require no evidence. The amount of evidence has nothing to do with the importance of the event. Facts are facts. Evidence is evidence. The consequence of the resurrection being true may be enormous, but how you go about investigating whether it in fact occurred or not is the same for any factual claim.
When we come back from this break, maybe it hasn't occurred to you, dear listener, but before we discuss a resurrection from the dead, we probably should discuss what is the evidence for Jesus' actual death. And that's an important thing, because most of the theories, the alternate theories or explanations for the empty tomb, center around the fact that Jesus wasn't really dead when he went into the tomb. We'll be right back.
Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, email, Google+. Simple ways that you can share Issues Etc. programs with your friends, relatives, and fellow parishioners. Just go to Listen on Demand Archives at issuesetc.org and look for the share feature images posted beneath each audio segment. You're only one click away from telling someone about Issues Etc. The Listen on Demand page at issuesetc.org and look for Share This.
Folks attending last year's Making the Case conference absolutely loved the barbecue from Randy's House of Barbecue in Troy and Highland, Illinois. The pork, chicken, ribs, and beef are prepared just like the old days in a pit cooked over hickory, apple, and wild cherry wood. Randy's House of Barbecue, Route 40 and Troy O'Fallon Road in Troy, and at 2649 Northtown Way in Highland. Randy's House of Barbecue, randysbbq.com.
You can teach lay people theology. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Does your church need a backup organist? The virtual organist service from Church Music Solutions is the next best thing to an on-site organist. Send us your musical choices, including liturgy and hymns. We'll assemble your service and send it to an iPad that controls your church's organ on Sunday. The result is genuine organ leadership on your instrument with your selections when you need it. See our videos on YouTube or visit our website at churchmusicsolutions.com.
Here's a special offer for Issues Etc. listeners. For any size gift during the Easter season, we'll send you a CD of an Easter sermon and a sermon on the prophet Job preached by Pastor Todd Wilkin. You can donate online, issuesetc.org. You can also donate by check. Issues Etc., Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. And for any size gift between Easter Sunday and Ascension Day, we'll send you a CD of two of Todd's sermons.
If you read Mark, the risen Christ never appears to anybody. Mark ends his gospel with verse 8 of chapter 16. That was such an abrupt ending that later people wrote an addition to Mark, verses 9 through 20, that you'll find in the King James Bible, but they're not in the original documents that we have of Mark's gospel. Mark stops with the women fleeing in fear and saying nothing to anyone because they are afraid, so that you don't get any appearance of the risen Christ to anybody in Mark's gospel. When you read Paul, and Paul wrote between 51 and 64, you don't get any description. You get a list of people whose eyes were able to see.
That's an excerpt from our interview in February with Bishop John Shelby Spong, kind of making his own feeble attempt to take apart the eyewitness accounts of the resurrection. We're talking about evidence for the resurrection of Christ on this Friday afternoon, April the 25th. Craig Parton is our guest. Craig, first we have to say, is it a fact that Jesus died, don't we?
Oh, yeah. And the evidence for the death of Jesus Christ, Todd, is really as sound and complete as any fact of the ancient world. It lines up pretty much precisely with what we are aware of first century Roman practices. You can check this out in A.N. Sherwin White's Roman Society and Roman Law in the New Testament. I mean, these centurions knew what they were doing. And the eyewitness accounts actually very perfectly describe the standard Roman procedure. And this isn't just my opinion. I mean, detailed forensic medical investigation of this kind of thing has reached that exact same conclusion. That article I did for Making the Case drops a footnote of four or five different medical journals done by MDs who've investigated the crucifixion of Jesus from a medical point of view. And all of them say this is consistent with what we know of the historical record, but this is consistent with the death of someone by asphyxiation through crucifixion. It's one of the best attested works that you can, a fact of the ancient world that you can come across. And I encourage the listeners to go back to the Journal of American Medical Association back in 1986 to an article called The Physical Death of Jesus Christ. And that's not exactly a religious journal, the AMA journal. And there you have some MDs dealing with the physical evidence that this man, by all accounts from the first primary source, first century documents, this man died on the cross. There's just no question about that.
There are a lot of alternate explanations that are put forward by skeptics as to what must have happened that resulted in people saying or believing that Jesus was raised from the dead. One of them that has been around for a long time, but it's kind of the alternate hypothesis du jour among the popularizers of this skepticism, is what we're dealing with is a dead Jesus, but who, while alive, had such an impact on people that it's kind of a psychological miracle that took place after he died. It's not that they wanted him to be alive. It was just he was so impactful that the only thing they could possibly think was that he can't still be dead. He must have risen.
You know, actually, the evidence, and you know, I'd encourage people who are listening to pull out the book of John and read the record. I mean, the evidence from the New Testament, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, is just the opposite. These people were no more convinced. They had to be convinced by the tactile physical contact with the risen Jesus Christ. I mean, Thomas is the classic example in John 20. This guy is not exactly leading Bible studies after the crucifixion. He's back to fishing. He's got his business trying to get back together. He won't even believe the women's testimony that they have seen the risen Christ. Basically, it's, you know, I've got to see him myself and touch his side and himself in order to convince me that this man is risen from the dead. So that's a nice theory that you just mentioned, but there's no facts to back it. That's not the perspective the disciples had. They were shocked when he appeared to them again. They were back to, most of them were back to their duties in the secular world after the crucifixion, and it was the absolute power and reality of that physical resurrection that brought them to the place where they had to say, this man is risen from the dead, and just as he said he would. And so you go back to the records themselves, and that's what mature people should do. When they're confronted with facts about what the real situation is, we shouldn't speculate about what could happen. I mean, it's also, you know, possible, like Robert Price and Dan Barker say in their works against the resurrection. You know, Peter felt remorse for denying Jesus. He's praying for forgiveness, thinks he hears a voice. He thinks Jesus is telling him he's forgiven, and pretty soon, 10, 15, 20 years later, that's morphed into Jesus actually appeared to me physically, and that's how you got the resurrection. That's a wonderful, nice theory. No evidence at all. I mean, I can make up 50 theories that don't have any evidence to them. And in a court of law, and I'll tell you, in a trial, speculation is not allowed. You've got to have a factual basis for what your position is, and those simply don't have any facts for them.
In the actual accounts of the death and resurrection, as a lawyer looking at them, are you disturbed? Is your confidence shaken by the fact that there are apparent discrepancies between the four accounts of the resurrection itself?
I would say differences, not discrepancies. There's certainly, and I would expect to have, with four witnesses of these events, I would not expect to have people cribbing off of each other and writing the exact same thing. If that was the case, there's obviously collusion. And in a court of law, you're not allowed to have four people say the same thing. It's cumulative. And it's not persuasive if people use the exact same language to describe an event. But I can tell you, if you have an accident at a corner, and you have four people that you interview about what happened in the accident, you will likely get four different, not discrepancies, but four different stories. Somebody is focused on a different aspect of that accident. They may be looking at the driver, they may be looking at the passenger, they may be looking at the car, the streetlight, the weather conditions. All of those together bring the full picture and context of what this event should be about. And that's what you have when you have the gospel records. The fact that we have four differing accounts with the same fundamental truths being presented in them is one of the greatest attestations of the truth of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. I mean, if this stuff was being fudged in order to rip people off and to try and convince them of something that didn't happen, you would never do four disparate accounts that can be harmonized. You'd have one sanitized version and you'd destroy all the rest. It's kind of like the Quran, of what they did with that back shortly after Muhammad's death. You destroy all the other versions in order to have, quote, one sanitized version.
With only a minute, after the facts have been established by this method, we really haven't answered the question, what does it mean that he rose from the dead, have we? With only a minute here, Craig, give us your nutshell summary. What does it mean?
Well, you know who I first ask about that? I don't ask contemporary theologians or people now out of the Christian church what they think it means. I ask the person first who accomplished his resurrection, does he say what it means? Because if he accomplished his resurrection and is God in the flesh, he's in the best place to be the best witness about what the resurrection means. And Jesus tells us this precisely, what the resurrection means. It means, in fact, that I did exactly what I said I would do, that I'm coming from the lost sheep of Israel, and to die an atoning death and resurrect again on the third day, just as I predicted to you. I'm the center of all Scripture in John 39 and Luke 24. And so when you have a lot of different opinions about what it means, you go to Jesus' opinion. I mean, he asked Peter that in Matthew 16, you know, there's a lot of opinions of who do people say that I am? The question is, who do you say that I am? Peter gets it right, you're the Christ, the Son of the living God, and Jesus blesses him for getting the right interpretation. So go to the right source for your interpretation. In this case, it's the man who accomplished his own resurrection.
Craig Parton is an attorney in Santa Barbara, California, United States Director for the International Academy of Apologetics, Evangelism, and Human Rights, author of a chapter in the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for April, Making the Case for Christianity. Craig's chapter is titled The Resurrection of Jesus Christ on Trial. There's great chapters in this book by Issues Etc. regular guests, Making the Case for Christianity, Responding to Modern Objections. You can get the book at our website, issuesetc.org, or by calling Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. Craig, thanks for being our guest.
My pleasure, Todd. Thank you.
In Hour 2 of Issues Etc. on this Friday afternoon, we're going to spend that hour with Pastor Brian Ketchelmeyer. You know him. He's a regular guest with us every week as we discuss Christ in the Old Testament. Now, If you've been following the regular order of readings in many churches, you'll notice that the Old Testament reading is actually from the New Testament, the book of Acts. That does not deter us. We will find the Old Testament roots of the Acts reading in 2 Chronicles 13, finding Christ in the Old Testament in hour two of Issues, Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Lutheran Public Radio, P.O. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
You know you want to be there. A pile of pastors, a mountain of musicians, a boatload of laity, all passionate about worship, gathered together on the beautiful campus of Concordia University, Nebraska, this coming July, the 28th through the 31st. Comfort, comfort ye my people, preaching, praying, and singing the comfort of Christ to the troubled conscience and the broken heart. John Kleinick, Paul Solek, Betsy Werner, Brian Wolfmiller, Robin Lever, and the Stash himself, President Matthew Harrison. Oh yeah, and two other guys named Wilkin and Whedon, along with a whole pile of your favorite Issues, Etc. guests. Did I mention that the registration cost starts at just $175? Or that full-time students, including seminarians and deaconess students, pay just $25 registration? Yeah, seriously. I told you, you want to be there. For more information, click the link, Comfort Comfort, on the Issues, Etc. homepage, issuesetc.org.